who was a physician who tried, got it into his head that he would weigh the human soul by putting people on big scales as they died. And I loved that can-do spirit, that belief that we can use scientific method to prove something as imponderable as the soul.
And does that make you skeptical?
Well, Dr. McDougall's experiment was a little naive. I did not actually hold out much hope that was going to be the answer right there.
Now, is this guy a schemer, or was this actually pure science?
Well, it was pure science for its day. He tried to, and it was published in a legitimate medical journal of its day, American Medicine, I believe it was. And he had an MD, and he did try to do it as scrupulously as possible. So he wasn't a schemer or a nutcase. He was just somebody who didn't quite have the equipment that would have been necessary.
When people talk about the soul nowadays, they talk about where the soul lives, and they call it the afterlife. And what's your basic definition of this?
Oh, the afterlife could be anything from clouds, to, you know, the general idea of heaven, to, in the quantum mechanics, the more quantum mechanics approach would just be that you'd just be this energy that might persist and in who knows what form. So there are so many definitions of what the afterlife would look like, and I don't think anyone has the answer of exactly what it looks like.
I was watching the History Channel recently, and it was talking about how the afterlife became very popular in the wake of World War I. Why is that?
That's true. That's, yes, the heyday of seances and mediums and ectoplasm and people really believing that mediums were communicating with the beyond. This was in the 1920s, and after World War I, simply because almost everyone had lost someone in that war. And I think people become very invested in their beliefs. I mean, people had a real need to believe that these young men were somewhere else and possibly even able to communicate with them.
Did they want to hear the stories and find out where they were and what happened, or just what's going on now?
You mean the people who had died?
People they lost, yeah.
I think that it was just a comfort to know that they as personalities persisted somewhere. Mm.
You said the magical word ectoplasm back
yes.
there. So tell me all about that.
Ectoplasm, to my mind, is the strangest episode in the march of science. I think it was thought to be the physical manifestation of spirit energy. And there were certain mediums called materializing mediums who would produce this stuff. And sometimes it photographed very much like cheesecloth. Other times it was sort of a gloppy or something you find in the garbage can behind the butcher shop. Very, very, quite disgusting and peculiar stuff. But it was amazing in that there was a span of time when it was taken very seriously. The Sorbonne University had looked at ectoplasm in its labs. Scientific American ran a 5-part series at one point looking at these mediums and at ectoplasm. So it was a very peculiar period of time, and the way that mediums fooled people, because people in the seance would say, well, she was searched when she came in, she didn't have it, so she must have produced it somehow, and they couldn't figure out how. And as it turned out, sometimes they were actually regurgitating it. They were very talented regurgitators, which was that used to be a sideshow act. People who would swallow goldfish and bring them back up, and I guess that might have been the inspiration for it. And women were sometimes storing it in, as one researcher put it, their most convenient storage warehouse. I won't really be any more specific.
Could you get a grant to research that if you really wanted to? Maybe not, huh?
Yeah.
Are there any scientific studies being done on paranormal phenomenon right now in the United States that solely look at ectoplasm?
No, I don't know of any. Really, after some of the magicians came in, Harry Houdini and Harry Price, and showed what was going on and how these mediums were doing it, they sort of, there was a fall from grace, and you didn't really hear very much about ectoplasm. There are still spiritualist groups in England who claim to be producing it, but they didn't return my emails, unfortunately. I don't know of any research, no.
There are some phenomenal bits in your book where you're talking about all of the studies that you go and see. One you talked about was you took classes and actually were in school to be a medium. Another one is you set yourself up for some electromagnetic waves in your brain. Could you share some of this?
Sure. Well, the electromagnetic waves, that was an interesting one because, as a little background, people in ghost hunting groups, amateur ghost hunting groups, will go to a supposedly haunted place and they carry electromagnetic field meters, which register electromagnetic fields. And when there's a spike on the meter, it's thought, well, that's a ghost. That's a spiritual presence in this area. And there's a gentleman at the Laurentian University in Canada who thought, well, what if we take the ghost out of the equation? What if EMFs affect the brain in such a way that it causes you to feel a presence, a hallucinated presence? So he has an electromagnetic, it's essentially a haunt box where you go in and he puts this helmet on your head and he puts sends these waves through the right hemisphere of your brain. And people report all kinds of peculiar things since they do. He claims that 80% of the people who do this will sense a presence in the room or have some sort of hallucination.
And you did this?
And I did this.
And what, did your husband question what's wrong with you before you went ahead and did this?
I don't think I told him exactly what I was doing because he would have just bolted the door and said, you are out of your mind. I was a little nervous actually heading over there because the man driving the cab said, oh, what are you doing here at the university? I said, I'm going to see Dr. Persinger. And he said, oh, he's a strange man. I hear he mows his lawn in a three-piece suit and he keeps rats. But Dr. Persinger was actually quite a reasonable man. So it was an interesting experience. I did actually have a sort of a hallucination, but it didn't feel spooky at all. I guess I thought it would feel like a ghost, but in fact it felt like I was just hearing something. And I was disappointed in that. I wanted that Hollywood moment where everything, you know, the theremin music or the, you know, the sense that now we're in the paranormal, now we're in the supernatural. But it was just kind of a moment where I thought, well, that's weird.
Weren't you afraid you might get a vision of somebody in a past life or maybe somebody who's died recently in your life?
Oh, I was desperately hoping to feel that presence or scent. I was hoping to have a spooky experience, you know, for the sake of the book and also just because it's fun. I mean, I envy people who've had these inexplicable experiences. I think they're life enriching in a way.
Mm-hmm. What was it like to go to medium school?
Oh, I was hopeless. It was like taking a class that you're not well prepared for and you're the worst one in the class and you just feel completely out of your element. That's what it was like for me. I don't have any aptitude, but I was fascinated just to learn how do you teach someone something as ineffable as spirit communication, and I wasn't quite sure what they were going to teach us. It amounted to things like expand your energy, fill the room with your energy, and I don't really know how to access my energy, let alone get it out of me and into the room. So I didn't do very well. If they gave grades, I would have gotten a D.
When you were taking these experiments and going through the schools, did you feel like you were in the hands of capable scientific people, or did you feel like these were more maybe schemers that are trying to prove the whereabouts of the soul?
Well, I tried very hard to limit the book to people at accredited universities, mm-hmm. University of Arizona, University of Virginia, which is really the only way I knew to ground the book in science, in something that I could relate to as legitimate, as, you know, well thought out, well controlled. So the places that I went to were as legitimate as I could make them. So I did not get the sense that these were schemers trying to prove something. I didn't feel that they were fraudulently manipulating their data or trying to pull anything over on me. I think that sometimes they have a strong hope that what they discover will prove that there's an afterlife. I don't think that they are completely neutral, but then I think most researchers hope their research is going to go one way or the other in most fields of science.
What would you say was your absolute strangest part?
I guess the strangest moment might have been I spent some time at the University of Arizona. They were doing a study that involved the medium from the television show Medium.
Oh, you met her?
I met her.
Wow.
And she did a short she said that At one point, she stopped the proceedings of this experiment and said, I'm getting crosstalk. And she pointed to me and said, from your mother, and pointed to this cameraman and said, from your father, both of whom were dead. But so afterward, when she was done with the experimental portion, I said, well, what were you getting from my mother? Can you tell me? Can you make a connection or whatever it is that you do? And she did. She said a bunch of things that were quite either general or vague or didn't really fit. But then after that was over and I was talking with the researcher, there was a moment where she said something out of the blue. She said, I'm getting an hourglass that you turn over. Does your brother have one? And my brother actually collects hourglasses, which was a very, very specific and unique thing. But of course, I then thought, well, if this is my mother communicating to me, why are we talking about my brother? Why is it all about my brother? So it became quickly devolved into sibling rivalry in my head.
And you'd mentioned that's interesting about why would she be talking about your brother. You had said something along the lines of, when somebody has passed away and we're asking them questions, what we want to know is, where are they and can they see me now and things like that.
Exactly. Everybody here is dying to know, what do you do all day? What's the weather like? Do you eat? Do you have sex? Can you see me all the time? But that information never seems to come through. That's why I love this study. This was a study in which four mediums who were, you know, supposedly the best in their field were asking 40 questions about the afterlife to a couple of people who'd passed on. So they were really trying to get at those answers.
Before all this research, what did you just in your heart feel happens after people die?
I just assumed that the lights go out and that's it, and it's the million year nap.
A million year nap. That could be your third book.
All the pages will be blank.
You're right. You know, I have to say, throughout much of your book, I found myself thinking about Heaven's Gate. That's the cult that killed themselves in the mass suicide, and they all had the matching Nikes and the purple capes, and they did themselves in with sedatives and vodka and the plastic bags over their heads. And I guess the reason why was these victims apparently believed they were going to meet up with the UFO hiding behind Hale-Bopp, the comet, back in 1997. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I'm amazed when people have such powerful faith that they become convinced that of this very specific afterlife that includes, you know, geographical features and what's going to happen and who's going to be there, whether it's, you know, virgins for you or Jesus, or because it's hard for me even to believe. I guess I'm just not somebody who was bestowed with faith. As a child, even though my mother tried very hard, I could imagine. I believe in the possibility of something more, something that we don't understand, some, you know, unified consciousness that we can't quite put our minds around. But the whole idea of an afterworld that can be described using terms, you know, descriptions similar to Earth, you know, that is amazing that people could put that much faith in it and actually kill themselves to get there sooner. It's amazing. I can't relate.
There's a woman named Suki Miller, and she has a theory that stage one of the afterlife journey is really the waiting stage. And it's almost likened to jet lag, where we're neither home, but we haven't truly arrived at our destination, so we're just waiting. We're just transforming. We're becoming used to not having a body, just kind of floating mm-hmm. in the netherland and just becoming accustomed to being dead.
Well, it's interesting if you look at ghost experiences. In other words, people having an experience of seeing somebody who they've just lost. There's research where people have looked at when those tend to happen, and the percentage of those, I mean, they're really high in the first few days, and then they drop off very, very quickly. So that I suppose would be suggestive of there being a period of time where people haven't quite gone all the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is just one little statistic that doesn't prove anything, but it is interesting. There's just a tremendous amount of them early on, right when somebody has lost someone. But of course, people are under a tremendous amount of stress, and the stress could be somehow contributing to something, some imbalance in the brain. Who knows? But it is true that there are far, far more reportings of ghosts in the first few days.
When you've departed back into the afterlife, then what do you really want to leave behind for your loved ones?
They want cash.
Yeah. Legacy, thoughts? You want to hover? What do you want to do?
How am I going to?
Okay, they like the answer,
right.
I'm sure.
I mean, what am I going to leave behind? Or you mean, how am I going to?
Whatever you want.
I don't know that I'm going to haunt anyone, because I think, I don't know that that would really, you know, the hauntings seem to be the things that people, you know, the knockings, and they're all so ambiguous, and I think it's just, it would be confusing for someone to say, is that Mary? Or if that is Mary, why doesn't she just come out and say what she wants instead of, you know, rapping on a door?
Well, she has that plastic bag over her head after finding a hail bop, and she's not going to be able to talk, right?
That's right.
It gets a little bit more confusing than that.
That's right. Yeah, the crypticness of spirit communication, I think, is it must be maddening if you're a medium to you know, you're just delivering. Well, I'm getting the letter H. I'm getting a small black dog. You know, oh, okay. How do I interpret this?
What is your ideal afterlife like?
Plenty of parking, free parking everywhere you go. All jeans make your butt look great.
Mm-hmm.
No jerks allowed. Dogs are silent. oh gosh, that's about it.
I'm with you. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Spook has a really fascinating cover. Were you part of the design process for that at all?
No, not at all. It's actually the same designer who designed Stiff, my first book, and he's over in England. There was an effort to keep the thematic thread going with the feet. You know, on Stiff, we have the feet, you know, on the slab, and here we've got feet disappearing off to wherever they're going. So I think that was a clever way to come about it. And it was important that the cover not seem typically new agey and spiritual, with light beings and swirling colors. Because the book is it's a fun read. It's goofy. It's my usual attention deficit self. It's not a ponderous, serious, either scientific or spiritual book. It's just me. It's just my take and me spending time with these people and seeing what's there, but mostly having a good time. So the cover and the title, really, we wanted that to be reflected that way.
And as a possibility, you wouldn't draw in the scientific crowd if it had angels and more unicorns or something a little bit more esoteric.
Yeah, I don't think that those readers will necessarily enjoy this book. So, yeah, there wasn't any sense in drawing them in. Yeah.
So being a science writer and also having, obviously, this huge fascination with death, how come you never pursued a mortuary career?
Oh, I don't have a fascination with death at all. It's interesting. You know, you take an author, say the guy who wrote the book about cod, this is a man who wrote an entire book about a species of fish, but no one says to him, I see you're obsessed with fish. So the second book was really just, I got interested in it from coming across Duncan McDougall and some of the early anatomist philosophers who were poking around in the human body looking for the soul. So that was a natural offshoot. But my third book will have nothing to do with either, because people think what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm
absolutely
obsessed with death. But I've never written about death. I've never been actually in any way engaged with cadavers or the afterlife. Neither book I think of as even about death. To me, a book about death is like Joan Didion's book right now, the book about having lost John Gregory Dunn. That is a book about death. The cadaver book was a book about medical research and all the peculiar things that have been done with bodies. It is about death, but it's, to my mind, not really. And this is a book about not death. This is a book about not dying, you know, the afterlife. So, of course, I'm splitting hairs here, but I'm actually not. No morticians, not suckled by morticians, no interest in a career. I enjoyed researching Stiff and was fascinated by everything I encountered, but had no desire to spend a great deal more time with bodies.
A highlight for me this last fall here was I was watching my favorite show, 6 Feet Under, and lo and behold, Nate hands a book to his brother David, and it's a copy of Stiff, your first book.
Yeah. Oh,
there it was.
Manna from heaven. And people emailed me the next day. I got at least 5 or 6 emails going, wow, great product placement. Your publisher did that. How fabulous. But that wasn't the case. It was Alan Ball just had the book, decided to put it in the show. We had sent a copy of it to him, hoping to get a blurb early on. Never did hear anything from him, but he had a copy and decided to put it in the show. And that was it. It was not something I initiated or pushed or my publisher. But it was fabulous.
Now, did he autograph the copy of your book and send it back to you?
I wish that he had. I sent him an email, an effusive email thanking him. I didn't hear back from him. You know, he's a very, I know people who've met him. He's a very humble, very well-mannered man. So it was just very nice of him.
So now you have a book on a fabulous television show, and you're a New York Times best-selling author. What happens? Do friends come out of the woodwork from grade school, or do people stop you on the street corner and take photos of you?
And no one's taking photographs. People do. For example, last night I had dinner with a woman who I went to high school with, who I have not spoken to since graduation day, who came across my book and thought, "Wow, is that the same Mary Roach?" So I do. Yes, I do have people tracking me down from time to time, but really my life is pretty much the same.
There's a lot of Mary Roaches out there in the world.
There are surprisingly many, many. I got an email today from someone saying, "Are you Mary Beth Roach from yada yada? If so, I'll come to your reading."
Oh, I see.
I should just lie. yeah, that's me.
One more body to fill the
yes.
chair. How did you decide to grow up and be a science writer?
Oh, I didn't decide. I had a useless BA from Wesleyan University. I graduated in the middle of a recession. I was doing copy editing and proofreading, which I'm not at all suited to because I'm not terribly detail-minded. And then I just gradually started doing some freelance writing. Science writing was never a plan. That was an editor approached me and said, "Would you like to write for Discover?" This was based on some work I was doing for Health magazine. So I took sort of a passive approach to my career and ended up doing some writing for Discover. But I don't even really think of myself as a science writer because I tend to tackle fairly, I guess you would say, my approach is a little lighter than most. It's not really rigorous science writing. So I don't even know what you would call me.
So you write out of your Oakland office.
Yes.
Is this a house or a building?
It's a building downtown with four other writers. I used to chair an
co-op.
Office. Yeah. Well, yes.
Nice.
It's mostly just a bunch of writers wanting to get out of the house and stay sane. I used to work out of my home for many years, but that is a little too much time with Mary Roach and no one else.
Hey, yeah, that'll do you in, especially with pajamas constantly.
Yeah, exactly.
What's this outside your window of your office? It's a statue?
Outside the window of my office is an apartment building, and it's a seniors apartment building, and there are balconies and residents who come out at different times of day, and so we entertain ourselves by sort of getting to know the people who come out on their balconies, and so it's just across the street. That's our view.
Do they know that they're in the presence of a New York Times best-selling author?
They have no idea. They don't know what I'm up to over there.
There's some great quotes throughout your book, and one question that you pose is about phlebotomy, and I really want to know, why is that best in autumn?
Phlebotomy, why best in autumn? This is an entry from the index of a book by Sanctorius, which is it's ancient, and I was reading the index, and I must confess that I wrote down some items. I think another one was leaping, its consequences.
Hmm.
And I never did look them up. I never got the answer.
So I won't get my answer today either.
I'll have to get back to you.
Do you have a guess about autumn?
Phlebotomy, why best in autumn? Oh, I don't know. I really, weather, I imagine. Humidity, maybe? I'm not sure.
Mary, you've been absolutely fascinating. We have time really for one last question here. Where do you really see the field of soul research headed here in the near future?
I think that if we ever have an answer to, you know, is there a future for the human soul when we die, I think it will come from quantum physics, quantum mechanics, and that very heady world of energy fields and microtubules and negentropy, which I unfortunately don't understand well. But that is where I could easily imagine answers coming from, that avenue of research. Maybe not proof, but answers, possibilities.
My guest today has been Mary Roach, author of Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife. Thank you so much, Mary, for joining us here at KABU.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Everyone is trying to get to the bar. Name of the bar. The bar is called heaven. The band in heaven, they play my favorite song. Play it one more time. All night long. Oh, heaven, heaven is a place where nothing, nothing ever happens. Heaven, heaven is a place.
Listening to KABU Community Radio 90.7. It's 9:30. Still to come on the radio zine, at 10 o'clock, Stephanie Potter interviews Lucy Liu of the Freedom Project, which supports the transition of prisoners into peacemakers to build safe communities founded on effective connections. And at 10:30, on stage and studio, Willamette Radio Theater presents A Christmas Carol.